have a lot of work to do to complete before the end of the year and work on recommendations for this coming session. We had a wonderful meeting last time. We were able to hear the presentations from two different states, Iowa and Illinois, and I hope that all of you review the minutes. Let's see, where is my agenda? I am going to give you a few minutes, if you haven't done that, to review the minutes so that we can approve those minutes and continue with the rest of the agenda.
I know we did not approve the minutes on September 20th last, or 18th last time, so we can do both of them.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Varner. So we need to approve the minutes from the last two meetings today. Any questions, any concerns, any additions to those minutes? If not, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
We're both September 18th and November 21st.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. We are approving the minutes from the last two meetings of our group. These two next items of the agenda are items that we had in our previous agenda and we were not able to cover, and I think it would be very helpful if we go through this very quickly before we move into putting together the recommendations and move into the part where we want to be in terms of reviewing the information from last week, and then figuring out how we put together some language for recommending, I think, what is a consensus around the table today, that we need to extend the work of this group because we feel like we've just begun, we're kind of grasping the issues, figuring out where we go, and now our term is expiring, so we will talk about that later. So we move into the Cultural Heritage Subcommittee update, which is Representative Gardner.
Thank you. We didn't actually meet as a subcommittee, but we sort of talked individually. In between a lot of our meetings, I spent time looking at where we've been in Minnesota as well as the U.S. I had a chance to meet with some folks who put together books like They Chose Minnesota, a survey of the state's ethnic groups, which is voluminous. And it's about 20 pages for everybody from French to Swedes to African Americans. You name it. So that was actually quite fascinating. We found out one of the towns that's just on the edge of my district in Centerville was actually created as a kind of a sub-colony of French Canadians who had started in Little Canada and then Centerville. So that would explain all the French names who were playing the lakes in my district for some of the farms that are still there. I also had the chance to meet with folks at the University of Minnesota at the Immigration History Research Center, which is focused mostly on post-war immigration, post-World War II immigration. Catherine Interlibrary Loan, The Legislative History of American Immigration Policy, 1798 to 1965.
Ooh. What did you do to have to look at that?
Well, I actually didn't read the whole thing, but, you know, since it came all the way from Marshall, I thought it was interesting. But it actually lists in Congress the breakdown by who was in the Congress at that time. It also lists any immigration-related planks in party platforms, including even the former Labor Party platform in 1932. So this guy really didn't have a life, I guess, to be able to put all of it together. But it was all very instructive. And for last time, I had actually put together a brief PowerPoint, but I decided that instead I would draw up a two or three page summary, which still needs a little bit of work, but I thought I would highlight some of the things that might spur some discussion later, or broader discussion later. It turns out that to nobody's surprise that the state and federal immigration policies since even colonial times has been very inconsistent, and it seems to ebb and flow with cycles of war and the economy. When during times of war, particularly in the early 20th century and times of economic uncertainty, governments have made it generally more difficult for people to enter and stay in the United States. And during the rest of the time, which is most of our history, immigration policy has been more liberal, mostly because of labor needs. Even though we look at the federal government as having jurisdiction over immigration today, there really was no major restriction on immigration by the federal government until 1875. So that was really called the unrestricted era. And even in Minnesota, from at statehood until 1920, we actually had a state immigration commissioner. I don't know what that person did or whether it was some patronage job where they just put you way up in the fourth floor of the Capitol or what, but I'd be interested to see what they actually did. There were times when federal dollars and land was given away to people no matter what their immigration status was. So the Federal Homestead Act in 1862 made land available to most people in America, not everybody, whether they were immigrants or not. And that was 160 acres of land for free, as long as you improved the land and had it for a year. Starting in 1875, well, just after World War I, Congress at times set limits on immigration, mostly based on race and ethnicity and some other factors that are unique to the immigrant. And probably the most notable example of that was the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which until 1943, when we were allies with China fighting the Japanese, we lifted most of those restrictions on Chinese immigration. That actually takes up a good chunk of this book. And it was mostly about concerns about competition for labor, but also what we would call today sex trafficking. Although because of being the 19th century, they said, we want to keep those women out. They didn't say, let's stop the people who are engaging in that practice. So that was a little disappointing to me. But in Minnesota in particular, World War I was a watershed period for trade and federal and state policy. Congress passed legislation in 1917 that required enemy alien registration. So anyone of German or German-Austrian parentage or Turkish parentage, whether they, even if they were naturalized as a U.S. citizen, was required to go see a U.S. Marshal and register. And so several of my wife's ancestors, great-grandparents, had to register with the United States government as an enemy alien. The only records that still exist are in Kansas from this federal program. And the first one that pops up when you look at it online is a guy who came over from Germany in 1850 that served in the Civil War for the Union and had been in the military in the western states for several decades. And his picture in 1918 shows him with his sergeant's uniform on. He was listed as an alien. I was surprised that even if you were naturalized, you had to do this. But all of these records have pretty much been destroyed. In Minnesota, 25% of the population fit that category.
What year was that?
1917. And they had to register by a certain date in 1918. By 1920, Congress, or from 1920 to 1965, they call that the quantitative or quota era, where Congress more or less restricted the number of immigrants by what part of the world that you came from. And that led to so-called hemispheric allotments, which essentially discouraged immigration from some parts of the world, notably Asia and Africa. And legislation in 1965 removed those allotments, and race was removed as a factor for exclusion by 1952. So it hasn't been all that long. But at other times, state and federal policy has made accommodations for increased immigration. From 1855, that was actually pre-statehood, to 1920, we had an immigration commissioner. During World War II, from 1943 to 1964, we had the Braceros program. I'm saying that right. That was actually designed to recruit labor from Mexico for agriculture in the United States. I guess I'll call it immigration, but on the issue of Native Americans, we've actually had policies of separation and deportation. Obviously, the treaties that were passed for areas in Minnesota restricted people to certain areas of the state, so you couldn't actually leave certain areas under certain conditions, and that actually led to the U.S.-Dakota conflict in 1862, which was a very violent and dark period in our history, and President Lincoln signed, as a response to that, the Indian Removal Act of 1863, which banished one group of people from outside, from inside Minnesota to lead the state, and that would be the Dakota people. And interestingly enough, Representative Erdahl is working on this. That is still on the books at the federal government. And so he and I are talking about a resolution to see if our congressional delegation would drop that. And this is interesting. Not all American Indians were automatically given U.S. citizenship until 1924. That was also kind of a surprise. We also didn't require passports, too, until step of World War I. So some of the things that we take for granted, I think, didn't take place until then. One of the issues that really played itself out in Minnesota was the process of Americanization. That's what it was called. There were concerns by a lot of people in the majority culture in the United States that there was a lot of what they called hyphenism going on, people identifying themselves by what their nationality was. And there actually were significant, what you call ethnic enclaves, large German, Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, Dutch populations in Minnesota. So there was an effort by many voluntary societies to promote what they call Americanization. And there actually were some really useful parts of that, particularly helping people learn English. I think there's things we learned about, like the New Iowan Center and the work in Illinois. We're trying to integrate people into all the services and rights and responsibilities they had. That was part of it. But it also tended to go a little bit overboard and stress conformity culturally rather than sort of acknowledging uniqueness within a pluralist culture. So there was a lot of stress on showing the flag, being as patriotic as possible, knowing patriotic songs and the like, particularly during World War I. But that stress on conformity actually created some reaction. So I think the desired outcome was to have people become American, and yet it made people want to be separate because they were asked to conform. The case where Minnesota kind of went overboard, I guess, is the only way I can put it. It was when we created this body, the state legislature, created the Minnesota Commission on Public Safety. We met only every 2 years at that time. And in 1917, during the last week of the session, we passed a law saying the governor, the attorney general, and a group of five or six citizens will have power to support the war effort. And it was taken very broadly, and it bent a lot of constitutional boundaries until the next legislature met in 1919. But one of the things that they did was try to uncover disloyalty. There's a mailing that was sent out of my district suggesting that I'm un-American for someone who views immigration. It was kind of the same thing. 25% of the population was of German heritage, and the Commission of Public Safety actually employed or contracted with people to spy on those communities to uncover disloyalty. There were really no other means of communication other than newspapers at the time. A little bit of phone service, but the Commission of Public Safety was trying to censor foreign language newspapers and, in effect, shut many of them down. What I thought was also interesting is they had some of these agents actually agitate against radicals in the labor movement, like the IWW, the Wobblies, who are more liberal than most of the mainstream labor movement, and in some cases they actually incited mob violence to throw some of the Wobblies out of town. In the case of Bemidji, where they just, along with the county sheriff, went in town and just said, get out of town or we'll let you have it. And some people were actually tarred and feathered. That still happened. They also were against the Nonpartisan League, which ended up, it was a North Dakota organization, kind of socialist in nature. They wanted state ownership of grain elevators, railroads, and all the means of production for agriculture, and they started working in Minnesota, and the Commission of Public Safety ended up using their network to go after them. But because they organized in immigrant communities, it also had a very anti-ethnic bent. We talked a little bit about states being asked to enforce federal law. This is what they asked county sheriffs to do. They authorized through general orders without any authorization from the legislature to enforce the Anti-Sedition Act. So sheriffs were often, they often banned or broke up meetings of anyone deemed to be disloyal, so they would break up meetings of nonpartisan league groups, and anybody that was talking about having any neutrality rallies. They also required all aliens to register with the state, not just people who are from German or Austrian parentage. So those records still exist. Those are housed in the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul. And so if you were from anywhere outside of the United States, you had to sign in by a certain date. Well, here's the one that kind of pushed this group over the edge and forced the governor to rebuke them. John McGee was one of the most acerbic members of the Commission on Public Safety. He was a lawyer and a judge. And he went and spoke in front of the U.S. Senate Committee on Military Affairs on April 19, 1918. And he was asked, along with other members of state commissions like this, to explain their effectiveness. Did they really help the war effort? And their major effort dealing with the war was to make sure no one interfered with the draft. They didn't want anyone to keep people from registering for the draft. So he said, where we made a mistake was in not establishing a firing squad in the first days of the war. We should now get busy and have that firing squad working overtime. The disloyal element in Minnesota is largely among the German Swedish people. The nation blundered at the start of the war of not dealing with these vipers. And Governor Bernquist said, okay, that's enough. And they gradually, once the war ended, their charge was supposed to end at the end of the war, and they folded by about 1920. The last thing I ended up reading a whole book on this, actually, was on the politics of language that gets brought up in the issue of state policy. And history provides some useful context. Statistics show that at the time of World War I that some 10,000 school children in Minnesota were being taught in the German language. And that caused people to freak out. And they it actually turned out later that most of these children were receiving bilingual education in both German and English. But that led to the passage in 1919 of a law that required all instruction and textbooks in Minnesota schools to be in English. And that law was repealed in 1987 and replaced with what I would call a sort of a bilingual assistance bill, which said that, you know, you can teach in the native language as a means of better learning English. And that's still in statute in 128.22 subdivision 9. The other issue I found, since we talked about the Medicare, generally speaking, was on Native American policy. Also, on the issue of language, official federal policy was to suppress Native languages, and so in Indian schools until 1933, Native languages were essentially banned. So Dakota and Ojibwe and others in the state of Minnesota went to Indian schools and were not even allowed to speak to their friends in their native language for fear of punishment. John Collier became the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in 1933 in the New Deal and essentially lifted a lot of those restrictions. But as a result, some languages that are not spoken anywhere in the world have almost disappeared, and so the legislature did appropriate some money last year, or in 2007, for Indian language instruction to be able to keep some of those languages going. You can hear Spanish or German or Thai or Hmong heard in other parts of the world, but you can't hear some of the languages that are indigenous to Minnesota anywhere else, so I think that that was a good idea. I need to craft this a little bit more clearly, but those are some of the main things that I found. I think there's some good things and bad things, but I think they were instructive as to how we look at some issues like enforcement of state law or federal law at the state level and some of the hazards that presents, some issues about language, and kind of the ups and downs that we've had. The author of this book said that there's no more complicated federal policy other than taxation than immigration, because it gets tweaked, and it's when people react to things, and so the policy goes up and down. And so I thought that was instructive. So.
Wow. Thank you.
So that's what I do when I wasn't for not doing anything.
I was going to ask, and you were running for office at the same time.
Well, we need something. After you say the same thing every day 100 times, like, oh, man, it's probably not going to have to do something to get to the
bottom look at me.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And this is actually you know, the Roseville Library in Ramsey County, there's a couple of copies that you can check out. I'm sure, I would strongly urge any of you to go upstairs in the state office building and visit the Legislative Reference Library. I'd like to sort of, I want to find out about the Commission of Immigration. Did they actually do anything? Were there any policies that we pursued? And where that material may be, I don't know.
Yeah. And it occurs to me, as you were doing your presentation, Representative Gardner, that maybe what we need to do when we get an extension is really think about how we could hire some interns to work with us to really go into this information and put together, you know, compile this information so that we can use it for our report. Because we have a lot of information, you know, in reports where the reports that you distributed the previous meeting before the last were absolutely excellent. And so we have, you know, great information that really needs to be compiled and used for our recommendations. This was a great report. Thank you. Very, very good. Next, we have Gloria. Gloria and John are providing an update of the statewide meeting subcommittee. And if you could let us know, you know, what do we know, what did you guys find out?
And before we go, I just wanted to thank Representative Gardner for that wonderful historical portrait. I hope that we would receive a copy of it, but also that you would educate your colleagues here in the legislature on the history and so debate in this hallowed halls will be more reasoned and illuminated to the light of history. So it's a teaching moment, I think, for everybody, including us, Allison. So thank you for the work, and I want to officially also congratulate all our legislative colleagues who've come back, re-elected. We're glad to see you back, and that kind of support is going to be important as we move forward.
Thank you, Dr. Furry. I think it's so important that we recognize that, especially in light of this. I really want to pass this around so that you see what he faced during election time. So we are very proud that you were re-elected and that you are here doing this work with us. Thank you.
Including Representative Hamilton, who's back but not here.
Yeah.
And we will go into that conversation right after this committee report, because that, I think, is part of, I'm just going to say this now briefly, just because it's so important, Dr. Curry, what you said. What I find with Representative Hamilton, with Senator Gimsey, Representative Gardner, and that's the reason they're here, is that they really are committed to this issue. They really want to work with us to make sure that the state moves in a direction that, you know, embraces immigration, really supports immigrants. But I think that every time we talk about this issue constructively, we get these kind of responses from some of the most conservative groups that really have a very different view about immigration. And I want us to talk about, you know, how do we deal with that? Because we're never going to be able to have these conversations in this place if we don't acknowledge that fact, that the politics related to these issues are very clear, very strong, and it is very difficult for those of us who are in public office to deal with it. But we're going to give the floor to Gloria so that she can give us a little update on that for me, and then we'll move on to that conversation.
Well, thank you, Senator Torres. I actually was hoping that John P. Clark would be able to give the update on the subcommittee meeting, but I'm happy to do it as well. We met on October 13th, and I believe we had it felt like a constructive meeting. We had David Zander there from the Asian Council, and we had Mr. Keller and Mr. Hupart and Representative Gardner there as well. We discussed the possibility of the statewide meetings that were part of our broader discussions here at this table. There is consensus that the idea of statewide meetings are, there's consensus that it's positive and that it's something that would be constructive to the work of this committee. However, at this point, we, aside from the fact that we discussed the content, what they would be like, what they would propose to do, what the goal would be, I think that we decided we would wait a bit, given that we're not necessarily sure. We would wait on making any recommendations because we're not certain of the recommendation for future work of the working committee. So if we had, for example, decided that we might want to initiate an initial statewide meeting, even in one location, then if we were not renewed as a committee, then that would be fruitless at this point to discuss that. But there is consensus. I believe someone mentioned that it would be helpful to even begin those conversations here. I think that there are people who are willing to or interested in being a part of those discussions, whether they're very extreme conservative opinion or those in the middle or those on the other side. I think that there are people who are interested in giving their input and being a part of this conversation. So I think that's really the goal, to bring people into this conversation so that they feel that they're a part of the outcomes of this working group. That's really my update. Is there anything else? John, the notes are here. Thanks, Sally, for putting these together. Anything else that anyone else wants to add about what was discussed?
No, I was not able to be at the meeting. I was on the phone. I was just going to say that I wasn't at this meeting, but not
yes, you were. Yeah, hi. Recording your name.
I'm going to steel trap my memory as these days. So I certainly can't add anything to this.
Well, your comments were actually very useful because you pointed out the planning and resources, given that you had done some statewide meetings yourself, and that you found them to be useful, but incredibly resource and heavily, you know, driven around what's the capacity of our group. At this point, without a budget, it would be a little difficult. But we're not putting the idea aside, and there are resources out there that we can certainly tap into, because I believe that this isn't the only group that wants to get out there and start talking about immigration to the broader community. That's really it.
Thank you very much. We are now going to really move into putting together the recommendations and moving forward with what we really need to do to present during this session. Part of the, I think, of what I hear from all of you is that very definitely we need and we would like to ask for an extension so that we can continue this work. I am going to share with you at least some of my personal views with respect to that, and I would like to open that for you to please share your recommendations, your views. I feel very strongly that we need more time to really look into this, but I also would like to recommend that we really put some boundaries and clarify the language about, you know, kind of the responsibility of this group. I say this because I think that the language that we have in place is so broad that has kind of created this discussions where people kind of disagree. Are we looking really at heritage and contributions of different groups to the state? What does that mean? Does it mean culture? Does it mean economy? Does it mean, you know, growth in demographics? What does that mean, looking at the contributions of new immigrants? That's one group. Another group is saying, well, let's be practical about this. There are some aspects of immigration that are challenging to our state and to our economy. Some of these is, you know, kind of the growth of population, the language, the education, the legal status of certain individuals. Some of the restrictions in policies tied to those,
that status of some individuals. The responsibility of federal government and state government, and what is that you need to do? So those are kind of practical questions related to immigration status. And then the final one is kind of some of the personal connections that we have to different groups. Some of us are immigrants ourselves, and this is very personal to us. And so we bring this emotional, personal aspect of our lives to this table and want to fight for really transformation in policy when we talk about immigration. And others are saying, well, don't go that far because we don't need to go that far. We're doing well in many areas. So those are three aspects that I think we really need to bring to the table. I had a suggestion. And so this particular language that we have in place today kind of opens the door for all of it. We can talk about ethnic heritage contribution of immigrants in all aspects of culture and economics and demographics. We can talk about the practical aspects of you know, immigration and economies and labor. We can talk about certain aspects of immigration that are problematic to states or are assets to states. We can talk about immigration reform, the federal government, the state, the responsibilities of cities. I can go as far as I really would like to go as an immigrant person who is in this position of, in the Senate. Some may want to balance that. So I want us to really think about how we could move in a direction where we are more clear about what is that really we could do from here and move in that direction, knowing that, you know, there are lots of things that we can do, but we need to be practical about, you know, deciding where is that, that we could go. So I wanted to suggest today, after the conversations with Illinois and Iowa, what I thought we could do is that if we ask the legislature for an extension in our time, is that we use that time to do two things. One is to do an assessment of the current programs that serve immigrants in the state of Minnesota. We have multiple programs that are federally funded and funded by the state and the cities and the counties and the foundations. They're all over the place. And they collectively or independently are supposed to be helping us figure out, you know, how to serve the immigrant community. I personally don't know how that works because they're all over the map. And I think it would be to the advantage of this group to really figure out how these groups actually work, how much money they get, what do, how do they help immigrants, all immigrants in general. Having an idea of how these programs work would give us, I think, a better sense of what is going on with our immigrant community today. I think that we also need to include in that assessment a labor and economic aspect of immigration that the private sector can help us with. We could also look at education. And within the public sector, I think we should look at education. So those three components seem to be issues that we talk about again and again. So really looking at what are the programs that exist today, how do they support or not support immigrants? Are they funded? Are they at a, you know, they have a current funding level that actually supports those immigrants in terms of becoming self-sufficient, trained, and ready to you know, be contributing members of society? My guess is that that opportunity will give us a chance to look into something that all of us collectively at this table are interested in, which is to look at this subgroup of individuals who are here, who may have come to this state under different circumstances, not under refugee asylum, not under political asylum, but simply migrated or immigrated to this state, and legal status, language is preventing them from integrating into society. And then we look at this group as an independent group and look at what are the recommendations that we could put in place, whether they, and those recommendations could include that our work needs to connect with our federal representatives in Congress and in the Senate in order to move forward specific recommendations related to immigration and related to education that are funded through federal dollars. And I think that doing the hearings, Representative Hamilton feels very strongly that we need to have hearings throughout the state of Minnesota to hear the stories about the people that work in the factories, about, you know, from the parents that struggle with school issues. He feels very strongly that we need to take our group to different parts of the state to really have these hearings and hear the stories from the individuals to deal with these issues day in and day out. I wanted to bring this up to the group. This is just my personal, I think at this point, input and recommendation based on what we heard from the two states and what we've heard during the last few days. Please let us know what other things you think we need to go into
I need to include something that's critical, and I kept bringing it up for a while about other organizations and groups that are interested in doing very similar work, or work that parallels the goals and interests of this working group. Many of you may not be aware, but I've left Central Legal as of November 30th, and I've become a private attorney and private consultant. But one of my largest clients is the Minneapolis Foundation. And the Minneapolis Foundation has committed resources and myself as a lead consultant on a statewide immigration project. Now that project is being sort of constructed and discussed as time moves along in the next few weeks. But part of that is going to be working on an assessment of what is occurring in the state on immigration. So there are, you know, I want to be cautious about what I commit myself to doing, but at the same time, there are partnerships now that can be made and that are tangible, and that's my work. I mean, I'm doing that. The second piece is there is a strong interest in ensuring that what is occurring here on a statewide level is also in sort of, it's occurring at the same time, or at least the conversations that are occurring on a statewide level link up somehow with the national conversation, because some of these issues, the federal issues, tie very closely with the state issues, and sometimes they get a little mixed up, but we think that that's an important factor. There are other sort of facets to the development of the work that I'll be doing there, but I just wanted to throw that out to all of you, because I think that there are now tangible ways to partner with a major foundation in the Twin Cities. There will be invitation to other foundations locally and nationally to partner on the project. It's great when we see that a foundation is willing to put forward some resources and energy behind an initiative like this. And so I look forward to talking with you all more about that. Mentioned it to a few members of the group, but it's official now, and I thought that might be helpful for this group.
Oh, absolutely. I had a brief conversation with Jose Gonzalez from the Bush Foundation, who apparently is really looking at similar ideas. He was here at our last meeting in the audience, but apparently the foundation is really having some very preliminary conversations about that work. It would be so wonderful for us really to partner, because we're not going to have the resources to do all the work that we need to do. And if some of the foundations could partner with us, you know, to take the group to different places, have the hearings, our staff could work collaboratively with the foundation staff and come up with reports that we can put collectively. I think that would save a lot of resources for both of us. And because ultimately, I think we want to get to the same place.
I agree, and you know, our goal will be, of course, supporting the nonprofits that are doing the work, but also to provide an opportunity and a place for sharing good information, sharing data, sharing reports, and then also providing a place where that information is then disseminated. I mean, what what Representative Gardner shared today is incredibly useful, because there are parallels and similarities and patterns that we see presenting themselves today simply with a different group of individuals, primarily those from Latin America. So I think as I move along in my work, I will certainly stay in conversation with all of you. I hopefully will stay on and continue to be a part of this table. And I am aware that other foundations are working on similar statewide projects or similar interests in immigration. There are a lot of opportunities for collaboration among the foundations, especially during this challenging economic time.
I appreciate that. I think your suggestions, and I think the way we might articulate it is that our collective deliberation in these few months led us to the need to focus the future work in certain areas, and if you have something for us to read, we can kind of work on fine-tuning it. My concern is leaving, I think today there's a budget announcement or somewhere, where then everything is going to hit movies, and they're gonna, this plan is going to be one low priority, and it may or may not come up, and so I'm concerned that we leave this session with a clear statement. Whether they call us to make a statement, we make a statement. I'm going to offer, I just thought of what I meant, I couldn't get a copy to you, a little bit of a background. During Governor Ventura's time, he appointed me to chair the Working Group on Minority Business Development, and after that, we came up with something called the Emerging Market Alliance Declaration that he took to the Senate, National Senate, and showed everybody, said, see what we're doing in Minnesota. But it provides a framework of looking at immigrants and minorities. I'm going to read just the suggestion. It's kind of like a declaration first documenting the different contributions of the community, and then it says, we call upon our community leaders pledge to continue to offer a culture of friendliness and hospitality to all who come to Minnesota, provide opportunities for economic self-reliance through nurturing entrepreneurship in these communities, invest in education and skill development, and provide a learning environment that encourages both academic excellence and cultural sensitivity, ensure that policies, programs, and institutions in the state are flexible to the needs of new immigrants and other groups, include the group in the civic life as both participants and leaders, and ensure that immigration policies and institutions such as Homeland Security or Department of Public Safety, we can add whatever we want, respect the dignity of the immigrant, unite families, and help meet the labor needs of the state. And so kind of touching those major areas of the environment of hospitality that we would like, the friendliness that's characteristically Minnesotan, that we focus on economic self-reliance. There's hardly anybody who disagrees that we need to encourage entrepreneurship. And that's the asset, as the latest report talks about, all these things. Investment in education and skill development, that's our future, and that's our challenge now. And policy, ensure that policies, programs, and institutions, and even people are flexible to the needs of the new groups, because one of the things that we found out that some changes require no money. Mm-hmm. It requires that public official who's acting as the gatekeeper mm-hmm. to maybe smile. And welcome people and say, hey, you're coming from a different angle, let me see what it is. But the usual response might be, hey, I don't understand your proposal, it's not the thing. So in that process, I say it from personal experience, because there was an official during the the working group who was actually a roadblock in the process. And would not see anything different. And I was saying, that's taxpayers' money. You are a public official. You've got to make sure you are the face of Minnesota. I think especially that is very important. And then inclusion of civic life. Again, everybody, I don't see anybody who would disagree on that. And call upon the national institutions. One of the most horrible experiences anyone can have is meeting a U.S. official on the border who treats you like a piece of dirt. And there's no reason why you can't. Maybe the circumstances are there, but you can enforce the law but respect the person's dignity. I'll give you an example. It was a Northwest Airlines strike, and my mother-in-law was 70 at the time. Northwest Airlines flights were canceled. So she was in Toronto. She hopped on the bus to come here. At the border, the immigration official suspected she's a one-go bag. Made her pull her suitcase. She said, "I can't lift." They made her pull it out. Opened all her letters and stuff and started reading. The staff were questioning her, and then after that told her to put her stuff back, carted her across the border and left her there. 2 o'clock in the morning, we get a call from here that she's waiting in the border for a ride from my brother-in-law to come from Toronto. This is about a couple of hours journey to pick her up. So he came the next morning, he showed the documentation, she came across the thing. But I say, that should not happen. And it's an experience I can tell personally, but I've seen that the face of our authorities, I think you can do both. I think you can enforce the law and you can be respectful. And so when I was coming, last time I came from overseas, the custom official looked at me and said, what do you have in your suitcase? And I said, I have some things I brought, and he asked some details, and then, "Did you bring any pickles?" I said, "I can get it out here. What do I need to get pickles?" But I don't mind him asking the question. He has a right to ask the question. But the tone of his voice and the way he asked me was not something. Later I said, I should not have let him talk to me like that. I said, "You have every right to ask me what is my suitcase. I'll open and show you what it is. But talk to me with respect." So I think we need to ask people that we have a conversation in a civic, in a civilized way, and so that people then will not. There's one thing that makes people mad at you is that when you get in front of a face of the country or the state, and they make you feel bad. They'll never forget. They'll never forgive you.
Well, pickle security.
So I'm saying this framework. If we as a body come up with a statement, say we looked at some things. As we move forward, we ask for it, but we also have this declaration that we sign on to. Mm-hmm. And we call upon everybody to sign on to, and we can work with the language and put the stuff, but it's something I think if we don't get renewed, we've done our share by saying, this is the Minnesota we want.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I really appreciate what Dr. Corey was saying, and also what Representative Gardner said relative to the fluctuations and the good and bad times and the impact that they have had on immigration policy. What I'm suggesting essentially is sort of a tag along on that, and that is that before any kind of substantive recommendation be developed, that there be some kind of philosophical principles, and this gets to somewhat of what Dr. Corey was saying. Getting them, I mean, this is a human rights issue. And as that, you know, we subscribe to, appropriate treatment, you know, treating individuals as humans and whatever. Because what we see essentially is that immigration policy has been used willy-nilly historically. And in many instances, has violated the constitutional principles that are supposed to benefit everybody in this country. So what I'm suggesting essentially is that we develop something like that declaration that focuses on the particular principles, because what we're lacking here in this state and elsewhere in this country is community and political will. And without this kind of agreement from a philosophical position, we're not going to get any kind of agreement on the particular specific substantive issue areas.
Yes.
A couple of observations and a You know, one thing I think was very important is just look at the history. I think there are many things that we've done poorly, many things we've done well, and I think that's a good thing to look at, and we learn from those, obviously, I think, as we progress. But the challenge is going to be the political will. Mm-hmm. And right now, the political will isn't helpful.
Give it a couple of weeks.
This is another thing that's going to take a little time. But one of the things I think is good to look at, and this didn't necessarily affect us, how it did at the state level, was what happened in 2006 when the reform, they tried to do immigration reform. And it was an interesting look at that, because my assessment of how that failed was, I think from what I saw or read about half the people had some decent understanding of immigration issues, and about half our population did. Of the half that did, there was a very strong vocal group that really had the enforcement mentality at that point. And that's what took up the radio lines, radio waves, the TV, that's what flooded and shut down the switchboards in Washington. And so, you know, history tells you that those are going to take place, and I think that's part of why it failed. So why did that fail? I think a lot of it was a very poor message. I think they lost control of the proponents of what they were trying to do, lost control of the message, and they didn't really relate to the general public on how does this affect me. And I think that's what this comes down to, is how does it affect me? You know, we have to decide who's going to be our audience. Is it the legislature, or is it the citizens of the state? Who are you vote? And I think when you look at that, you have to determine on how it's going to affect me as a citizen out there, and how it's going to affect me back in my district with regards to this. So I think that's the thing. So I think the historical perspective is very good. I think we can come with a concise document. People don't think about that very often. And when you think about the early immigrants coming to the United States, the German, the Irish, how they were ostracized. You were Catholic. If you were Protestant, it was ugly. And it was brutal, much more brutal brutality than you see it today was. And so people need to be reminded that we've gone through this, and it is a difficult issue, but our country has a history of rising above these things. And I think that's a positive message. And the other part it gets down to is, you know, we've talked about this before, what is our current labor need? You know, we're going to be a little bit challenged right now, so it's probably a good time to have some time to work on this because of the recession, so you're going to have a lot of, you know, employment's going to rise and so on. So people will be saying, you know, these people are taking our jobs and so on. So I think we can get over that. But you have to look 10, 20, 30 years down the road, as Mr. Gillespie has done. You know, our challenge is going to be, where's our labor force going to come from? It's not there. And so I think you talk to rational general public on that. I think that's positive, that people can understand that. And, you know, so I think what Gloria mentioned, the new senator mentioned, the assessment of what our current needs, I think that's very good. And what you're doing with the foundations, you can bring the foundations together. And fortunately, if funding that can be helpful in bringing some of this together, is I think that will help us also craft our strategy position and where we go from here. But I think it really comes down to our messaging being is trumping, you know, trumping the rhetoric. I think we can be very concise. I suggest we be very concise with our report. It has to be well scripted, and I think with those type of things, you can trump the rhetoric. The rhetoric is always going to be out there. You're going to have these support groups out there. They're vocal, they're energized, and they're not willing to listen to facts. But you can trump them. Most, I think, the general public appreciate that, and if they're given the right information. So I guess that's just kind of a random assessment of where I think we can go.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Seems that we are very much in agreement with really putting together a report that first asks for the extension, give us more time. I'm inclined to say that we ask for 2 years. A year goes too fast. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the year is that 6 months out of the year, we're in session. And so it's really only about 5 months, you know, 6 months that we have to really work on this in a very significant way.
So we go for the extension, and then really looking at what Joe was saying in terms of having a very, and Mr. Banks, Mr. Curry, all, you know, all the things that you're proposing, Gloria, in terms of putting together a very brief report, very concrete report, looking at the historic perspective so that we remind people that this is not new, this is what we go through the years, and have gone through our history. Then looking at the current labor and need of really looking at the perspective of now and 20 years from now, why we need to do this, why we need to take a look at this, really looking at the issue of principles, the declaration of principles, like the two of you were saying, you know, what are some of the fundamental values that connect us, that really represent Minnesota's values with respect to immigration, and then looking at a very practical assessment of what is that we have out there, which we're not going to be able to do now, but we can say in the report that we really would like to have the time to get into that, really understanding what are the resources that are available right now that are funded through federal government, state government, cities, you know, declarations that cities have put together, you know, to really support this, that really support our argument for continuing to work in that direction. And then really refining the language that we have in place right now, because I think the language that is in place right now is just too broad. So we really need to put a little bit more substance to the language in terms of saying, you know, these 2 years are going to be about conducting an assessment, looking at labor trends and training, looking at, you know, business development. I think we really need to incorporate some language into this recommendation that gives us a little bit more kind of practical language as to what is that this group is supposed to be doing. Meeting throughout the state of Minnesota with different constituency groups to hear their perspective, not just saying, you know, looking at contributions of different cultural groups, because that is just way too broad, and so making it more specific. We will give it a try and look at, you know, combining the ideas and the language that we reviewed today. And I am leaving the country next Tuesday. I will be gone for a month, but I will have access through email and I could review this so that I could be connected. But I would really like to ask for your support and your time. You need to review this with us. Just take a look at this language. Make sure that from your perspective as a community advocate, as an attorney, as a business person, really this connects, you know, all of the arguments and the, you know, the proposals that we're making today. We really need concrete language. You know, in policy, people will read just the first page. Our colleagues will not read the second page. If they read half of the first page, we are lucky. If they read a page, that's very lucky. So we really need to be able to capture their attention through very brief reports and really put together the compelling arguments in a very succinct way. And then we can add, you know, more information. And for those, you know, that actually do read the books and do the research, we can provide, you know, those opportunities and that information to them. Any other comments? Things that we're missing at this point?
I would just suggest we lead on the economic side, like this on the declaration, but and everybody looking for something to drive us drive us out of recession. I think talking about purchasing power and people actually infusing cash into the economy, buying cars, buying houses, buying you name it, is a good lead. Because some people just look at the liability side of the ledger, not the asset side. And so I guess I'd say let's lead with the assets.
Just a little bit about the document. The original one was the Minnesota one. This was a version that we made for the city of St. Paul at that time, but really a wonderful moment.
If you will, I have a couple additions. First, compliments, I think, all around in terms of the interesting place that I think in my own preparation for the meeting was imagining where we would come to as a collective body. And I think I'm very encouraged and excited that this is a group of people from diverse walks that start out with similar interests in terms of the next phase. I really look at this as a phase project and a chance to inspire leadership and confirm good leadership that exists in terms of this area. So I think it's a great encouragement to me and should be to people who are serious about these issues in the state. And I want to make sure I said that. Second, I do think that first order of business is presenting a brief summary of why this is a value and of the potential added value that it adds to decision makers and to the general public, because I do think we have two audiences. And you can't, from my point of view, it's hard to address decision makers who depend on a knowing public for their reelection without also educating the knowing public of the value of why state officials are looking at it, federal immigration issues. So I think they do go hand in hand in terms of our audience and our messaging to those audiences. And then third, in terms of, in addition to the extension and the clarification, which I also agree with in terms of projections, I think it is easy to also learn from those bodies like Illinois and Iowa, so we don't reinvent the wheel in terms of phasing in where we're headed and where we could be headed. I don't think anything's written in stone, but a common denominator from both of their presentations was that what helped sell the value of their state commissions was a document. If I'm not mistaken, for Iowa it's tax-based or Illinois. One of them basically came around to the economics of the need to have a smart, welcoming, integrating, and also a funneling body that disseminated clear messages to now three audiences: decision makers, the elected officials, the general public, and then to immigrant and refugee communities themselves, that this is a place, Iowa, Illinois, and hopefully Minnesota, that values your presence, that needs your presence, and that needs you as new Americans and new Minnesotans to really not only just survive but to thrive, to grow our tax base, to buy, you know, abandoned houses or to move from renting to contract for deed. So I think there's a real opportunity to take some of those opportunities. That's why I was so passionate about getting them to give us some of their history that they've already, the roads they've already walked on. I think we can borrow some of that and phase it in. I think the real trick and challenge for us we'll be solving the urgency of the issues with the speed with which this working group in a fiscally neutral environment, which we have to anticipate as of today, if not negative, is going to be able to operate. And I really think the solution is, in the short term, and maybe the entire term, a three-legged approach, which includes government on all levels, particularly those affected by a larger percentage of immigrant refugees, as well as the state, as one stool of government, a philanthropic, as well as a business, three-legged stool to move this. And I think the philanthropic communities are both state and federal. One interesting, I forget which of the two states talked about, actually, I think it was McCarthy from Chicago, that really helped them to do the reports that educated the elected bodies and the public trust to invest in that area. And I think we can compete. We have such a compelling case in Minnesota as the final arrival spot for people from so many different backgrounds relative to other states. We are a unique place in the distribution of new Minnesotans who come from unique places. Our office is a good sort of anecdote. We represent about 2,000 cases last year from 86 different countries in our small nonprofit. And that is extremely attractive to national funders in terms of seed money, in terms of integration, which seems to be a concept that people are excited about. So I really look at that, this next phase. If phase one, which we're just completing, was, does it make sense? Is this a waste of time, or is this a value to legislators for the state? I think the answer, we all would agree, I haven't heard otherwise from anybody here, is that it is of value. The second is really, what is it we want to become? You know, I don't think we can become Illinois. I don't think that would be proper. But what is it from those commissions and similar ones that we'd like to incorporate and strive for and solve with seed funding? I think that's really phase two. And then I also think that it would be valuable for us as a body to make one or two concrete recommendations to this legislature about our observations or where we come from in terms of this group and where we've arrived after this first phase. I created a draft more to help me organize my thoughts, and I won't really burden you with it, but two of the thoughts were about the continuance of the working group, and the other 18 were all about specific proposals and areas. Again, with the mindset of a fiscally neutral environment that we're challenged with. But I think common areas that really express and clarify, again, in a fiscally neutral environment, some of what I've heard over the course of this time is the need to get a grasp on what our Minnesota economy needs and demands in general and from this emerging group of workers, from those three-legged entities. You know, Dr. Corey's done excellent work, but if this group could identify that as a need, we won't have that data to report with this report, but we will say we must, as a state, gather this information. I believe that we know what the result will be, basically that unless we invest, unless we welcome, and unless we do a better job of training new Minnesotans, the potential for economic growth is thwarted. So it's in all of our best interest for economics. I think that's one. And I think the other specific proposal that I would recommend that this body forward is to, once again, it passed the Senate, I want to say in 06, but once again to memorialize at the highest level possible our need, and this would be a recommendation to elected officials in the two bodies and the executive, that our need here at the state, like all the other 49 states, is for the federal government to resolve this issue, whether it be through a resolution or at the state level, or through a series of resolutions or one unifying resolution at the city and county level. I can tell you from personal experience in taking that Senate resolution to our 10 elected officials the last couple of years that it is of value. A lot of people are not certain that it is of value. It's a priceless memorialization in terms of fiscal cost, but the symbolic value of being able to go into some, no matter what their politics are, and say, you know what, Minnesota's state elected officials, as well as cities, who are really left holding the bag until you fix this issue, resolve and demand in a respectful way that you get it right with all due haste and urgency. I think those are two concrete proposals that we can forward at this time, in addition to really a standard of principles and declaration principles. But I think it helps to set, the third one, and I'll stop talking, is that I also think that we should, as a body made up of bipartisan elected officials as well as nonprofit and business and academia, offer ourselves to this coming session as a resource for immigration-related policy proposals, immigration-related conversations, and we can memorialize a commitment to bring in experts if we don't contain that capacity, but bring in experts to help think through and deliberate in a less brightly lit room than the floor of the legislature. Some of, perhaps it will all be about the budget, but I think we can do a better job of communicating that to our elected officials, that we are here, that we are a resource, and we'd be willing and happy to take on whatever the potential issue is. It may be contained in the 18 policy points that I thought are likely to occur.
We love to have you share them, John.
I can copy them right now.
Yeah. If you could mail it to us so that then we can take a look at, you know, how there is an overlap and then put into that. You know, this issue of incorporating some language to make this group as a group that that we can utilize as a group for, you know, really getting ideas and having conversations about this issue is so needed here. We really don't have a group that we can come to. And this is why it becomes so political, because I would look for my group,
yep,
and then you look for your group. Hopefully, you know, two of us are kind of looking for the same group. But, you know, everyone is looking for their own group, mm-hmm, to kind of validate their own thinking. And so we lose perspective of the real facts, of this history, of these principles, of these very concrete things that you are proposing, John. So I do think that there's a lot of value on trying to steer the House and the Senate in a direction where we, you know, we have attorneys who actually are immigration attorneys, and we have people who have worked with immigrant groups for years, have conducted research, you know, university business, mm-hmm, individuals who have tremendous experience that, you know, you can give us a perspective that is neutral and humane. We don't have that, and that's why we can just choose to, you know, bring whatever group we want to validate our thinking. I think that's a very good recommendation, and I think it needs to be part of the language, because that will help us to continue the next 2 years when other people bring other recommendations that are conflicting with what we bring from this group. And then we can say, well, bring it to the group and let's talk about it, rather than go on and put legislation, and then that legislation conflicts with the work that we're trying to do here. So I think that really needs to be part of the language in a very concrete way. And I am confident, you know, the whole issue of the economics of today could be actually a good thing for us, because I'm thinking that people may be so consumed with that they're not thinking about this. It will give us just, you know, the flexibility to kind of go on and do the work. That's my hope, that they would just simply say, go ahead, you know, we're so busy trying to do this, and then they would give us that opportunity to really put this language together and do it. If we don't have, yes?
There's one point, and I wanted to pick up on what Joe said. Mm-hmm. I just recently read some research. It was a Newsweek, very fascinating. Brain research. When they study people's brain, when the issues of racism and stuff, it goes to the very bottom of the brain. It starts there. The way the fear, it's called the amygdala.
Amygdala.
I wanted to start the amygdala society. but as you move upwards, it becomes, the tolerance goes to other higher parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. And just reflecting on the election, I think what President-elect Obama and the national debates did, in people's mind, I think he moved it to higher levels of where people were more accepting, and said, so the message, I think the messaging is right, and how we help people move from the anxieties and the fears to something that allows them to be open, because I think most people will get there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Senator, something John said, kind of to build on that, if we can build a compelling story and show a path that can bring results to helping resolve some of these issues within Minnesota, I think ultimately we would be very pleased and successful if we could arm our federal officials, our congressmen and senators, with something that they can take to Washington and show people.
it off to the side if she continues to get that type of activity. So, you know, that can, if I was a federal official, I might be quite embarrassed by that, but it'd also be quite inspiring for me to do something for planning with that and take up that. So I think we need to really think about what we take that. It's good for Minnesota here, but ultimately, can we help at the federal level? Because that's our frustration, as you're many around the table, is their lack of fortitude to take this on.
How it just has become a political issue that it just doesn't move in any direction. It's just really used as a political wedge issue. We're not making any progress. We're just not moving.
Well, and I think that, excuse me, the importance of what gets lost, in my observation, when folks are in Washington, is the urgency that local towns and communities have around this issue. Even though they'll hear from constituents, they tend to hear only from an enforcement side of their local constituents. And this is really an opportunity to say, you know, we aren't going to deny the need for enforcement or to only play the opposite side of that, but we need a holistic solution that deals with this from Minnesota and a local city and town point of view. And unfortunately, they hold all the cards, really, in solving many of the problems that towns and cities are expending dollars on, and we're, you know, gathered to try to figure out. So, you know, when my office began to do policy work and dedicate some funding to it, we all assumed naively that that would be focused on the federal level because of, you know, if you had to evaluate, if I had to evaluate where real change has to happen, it's 99% federal. That doesn't mean that the state's role of 1% of improving lives for those that live here in the overall world of change is irrelevant. I think that it is extremely important that the messages we send reflect that. But the ultimate need to make change and to demand change in a respectful, professional way, we have to find creative ways to amplify that. And resolutions are one of them. I would love to see a unified resolution, including the executive, about the need for this. And I mean, there are areas where we agree based on past statements, the statements of National Governors Association. And I think that that there are many opportunities.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. I hope that we can capture all of these messages and be able to put it in writing. I think the challenge for us is always, you know, how do we make this compelling argument and make sure that it's compelling to all of these audiences. But we'll work on it. We'll put a draft together with these ideas, proposals for the language, and we are going to send it to you. Again, I encourage you to please take the time to read it, think about it, based on your research, your recommendations, what you know, strengthen that language, help us clean up the language and information you have, your thoughts, if you would like to share that with us, John, that information. Gloria, all of you, to please send it to us. Joe, please, Dr. Curry, send that information to us so that we can compile that information and put it together for you.
Would we be sending that information to Sally?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes, please.
Great, because I have a couple.
Yeah, everything to Sally, and then we will work together on putting this together through email, and then we will convene another meeting at the beginning of the session. We will schedule that meeting very soon. You know, we can look at my schedule and your schedule. And then during the beginning of the session, we will be here and we'll have the time to meet and look at that and see how do we present this if we've got a hearing about the logistics of that we work on. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Yes, I see. Hey, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of the
chair.
It's a useful service because of all those.
Because I mean, I think that if the group, if they also see the
what I think saves that sort of jurisdictional legal house and that
influx of money.
Set up in different language, but we have empowered, not power,
that's right.
that need that and have to access it. And as a result, most of them, a lot of their money goes to.
Right, because you know, we, particularly in these.
But that, I think, is secondary.
Are going to be, our population is going to be seriously negatively affected. Because, government grants are going to be even more narrow. And they're going to go to those organizations that traditionally have received it. And unfortunately, they, none of the states departments have really effective evaluation machines. And so they make these decisions, not only because of set criteria, but because of their own predilections and their experience. And trying to get these organizations to come up with, like I used to review stuff for AIDS and STDs for populations of color. I said, people who are running for it, well, those of you make a judgment, this program's been in city here for the last 5 years. What did they get up with it? How effective were they? And the extent to which they provided, After today, all the big doom, we'll know what it is. And we'll be apprehensive, we'll just be sad.
But that's my fear.